Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school. Where book clubs are just for women, and generally we like beer.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
I'm Jimmy.
We're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are reading The Killer Angels by Michael Shara, and I'm starting with a beer. So they make a big deal in this book about
the Civil War.
About slaves. They make a big deal about, those are the guys wearing the blue and these are the guys wearing the gray. And they're always worried about their dress. And they're all masculine. But I bet at some points they had to admit in those uniforms, okay, we're kind of cute. This is Okay, We're Kind of Cute, a double IP from Little House Brewing Company. Which is, I've never heard of them before.
We had one from them before.
They're in Connecticut. I had the other three of this four pack, and it was great. This is very nice. Nice light double IPA to start the evening. Can I ask, did I pick this one?
No, why this are we was doing a patron this? Request.
Oh, thank God. Okay.
This was almost my punishment book for Jimmy.
Oh,
you know, it's actually going to be the whole trilogy. It's going to be the whole trilogy, actually.
That you can't do that. We have standards.
The omnibus, the Michael Shara collected works EPUB.
We can only we did two books one time because they made sense as a pair: Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter.
And they were each 82 pages.
And there was just as much fighting.
I understood those better, actually. So, The Killer Angels is a 1974 novel by Michael Shara.
Written for dads everywhere.
Yes, and dads have never been the same. Lawns have never been safe since this book came out. And chairs, easy chairs, have never been more filled.
Never were more armchair Monday morning generals born.
It is the novelization of the Battle of Gettysburg is really what it is. And I realized in reading it, I don't know fucking anything about the Battle of Gettysburg.
I knew that before I read it, and I realized it during also.
And after it ended, I realized I didn't learn anything about the Battle of Gettysburg.
But I have been to Gettysburg and took the tour.
Yeah, you were in the fight.
You went there as a soldier. You did fought there to preserve the Union, Nate.
I knew you'd
at least
that.
We didn't make you a Confederate. The joke. So
my edition started out with a little introduction by Michael Shara's son, who's the one who wrote the other two books. Yeah, Jeff.
But he wrote,
who cares?
The other two. He wrote the first book and the third book.
No, he wrote the second
Frank Herberted it. You know, he did that.
So basically, the foreword starts out with Jeff, whatever his name is, saying, "When I was a kid, I went to Gettysburg with my dad, and we took the tour, and the tour guide told us the story about these two generals who had been best friends before the war, but then they picked the opposite side, and here they were." Pickett's charge, one leading it, the other one like defending, and they both died right there. And he was like, my father was so overcome with emotion, I had never seen him cry before. But he was like a short story author, so he like was kind of a writer, and then took the next like 7 or 8 years and wrote a novelization of the Battle of Gettysburg. Did a bunch of research and like all this stuff and like made it into a novel, and this is the novel, and then nobody read it, and then it won the Pulitzer Prize, and then still nobody read it, and then finally they got a movie deal and his father like died before the movie deal happened, before the movie came out, and then the movie came out, the movie called Gettysburg,
which is a better title,
ridiculous fake facial hair. Yes, I have also seen the movie, but and then after the movie came out, the book hit like number one on New York Times bestseller list in 1993 or something like that. But it was barely read until then. And then after that book did really well. So his father was already dead. Jeff Shara went and wrote two more books about the Civil War, trying to cash in.
But it says it's book number two in the trilogy.
Yeah, he wrote a prequel called Gods and Generals.
Oh. I guess there was a bunch of war before that.
Which was Gettysburg also was only halfway through the war, so there was a bunch of stuff that happened first.
Okay. So in chronologically, in the in-universe of the books, he wrote the first one and the third one, and his dad had The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Weird.
Yep. And he started on a high point. Gettysburg is like the biggest battle of the war.
It's the only one people know. Like regular people.
People are always talking about man asses. And that battle name is just fucking hysterical.
There were two of those.
Hopefully more.
Man asses and Antietam is another one. I know that name. I think that was the deadliest single day of the war. But that's like a fact my dad said when he sat in a chair. So I don't know how true that is. Usually you could trust a dad on Civil War facts, but...
Gettysburg was the biggest battle, but it was 3 days.
It's like it was the Woodstock of the Civil War.
Everyone says they were there.
So it starts off, and it starts off with some quotes and shit that I skipped over. The one was a nice one from Woodrow Wilson, noted racist guy, about
very
like,
racist.
Holy
the
wars.
Quote was, "Hey, can we just take this whole thing back?"
He's like. Sometimes the good guys lose. Woodrow Wilson. I hope it rises again soon. But something like, you know, basically he was plagiarizing the Gettysburg Address. He said something like, a battle fought for freedom is a holy battle or something like that. And jihadists the world over were like, yeah, that's what we've been saying. So it starts off with the spy, Harrison. Harrison the Spy, the inspiration for Harriet the Spy.
Little known
and
fact, yeah.
He's going around, yeah, when men take up arms to set other men free, there is something sacred and holy in the warfare.
Except okay. Woodrow mm-hmm. definitely mm-hmm. didn't want those guys free.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Osama.
God wants them in chains. It starts off with the spy guy, Harrison, who's this like grimy guy, but apparently a real person. Who I was way more interested in reading his Wikipedia article than this book at certain points, so I read that whole thing. Who he lived until the 1920s, this guy.
1920s?
Yeah.
Jesus.
So I was thinking about it. Like 1974, it's like, you know, right around the centennial, people are feeling all sorts of patriotic fervor. But the last Civil War veterans died in the 50s. You know, they were like kids that fought in the Civil War, basically, or carried a flag or something. So...
But they lived long enough to be on television.
Yeah,
which
like
is
little
crazy.
Old as shit man who looks like Jeff Sessions' dad sitting there. And he's just
probably
like, ah.
Was Jeff Sessions' dad.
It was Jeff Sessions' grandfather. Thank you. Somebody who you know was related to or was directly called Beauregard. if he was from the wrong side. So the spy is like, I seen some shit. And things are moving. And... This book has many maps in it.
It has many maps. But they're really hard to see.
They're really hard to read. I don't know what the fuck. It's just like, look at this. And you have to remember 19 generals' names.
It does have the problem of, if you don't know some of this going into it, you're going to be like just bukkakied by names that come once and then leave.
That is how bukkakis work, Jimmy. So
that's why I chose the book.
Pukaki chooses you, as our most recent negative reviewer would agree. Yeah, there's a million names. And it starts with a little introduction where it gives you a bio of each guy. And you get introduced to a whole lot of just ridiculous 1800s names. Like Jubal Early. It's like, is that a gerbil name? What is a Jubal? How do you fucking name your
His
child
middle name is Lee.
Jubal? Jubal Early. Or Anderson Early.
Oh, Jubilee.
Oh, God damn you. That's Robert E. Lee's wife. or Ambrose Hill. Like, that's a name that has not been used since 1878.
Ambrose Bierce.
Yep. And then I also like Moxley Sorrel. Like, that's an oddly modern sounding
name. That's a name that you say when your mouth is full of... entire Clementine oranges, and you need to come up with a fake name real quick.
Over to wash these down. Where's my mint julep? Fuck it. So he has information.
Wilson Pickett,
and he's a spy
name,
for the
Confederacy.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so he's a spy.
But this is the one thing I remember. So let me say it because I'll be quiet the rest of the episode. he's like, I see the union guys moving around. And Lee is like, oh, spies are fucking gross because I am a gentleman and this is a war of gentlemen.
And he spends the entire book being real tired.
And they all have the shits.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. They all have, like, they're like, I got soldier's disease. Wink, wink. Like, yeah, man, I've been eating nothing but cherries for 3 days. I'm just shitting pomegranate seeds somehow. And they're like, oh, God. But he's like, I don't fucking trust the spy because they're disgusting. He's like, they're coming. There's a whole bunch of fucking, which this is probably what makes the book so interesting to dads, is that you get, like, you see how the war was fought so differently than what we're used to in the modern world, where they're like, I think that's the, like, they don't even know who they're fighting at times. They're like, whose army is that?
is that Larry?
I know it's the other side, but which fucking guy? Did you see horses? Like, the term fog of war, I don't think had been invented yet, but, like, they are in the, something denser than fog of war. It's like a glacier of war. Like, there's no information that happens. And so he's like, fuck it, we're going to trust him. To this little town that I've never heard of, Gettysburg, whatever it is, we're going to go there. We won't remember it in a day or two anyway. And you're reading this, you go, oh, just you wait. Hold on to your mint juleps, Robert E. Lee. Shit's about to go down. And then stuff happens, Nate, that you understood. So tell us all about that.
Recite the Battle of Gettysburg to us.
Okay, so learning about the Battle of Gettysburg, well, by that I actually mean watching the first half hour of the episode of Ken Burns' Civil War, where he talks about the Battle of Gettysburg, way more interesting than this book. It
he
is only
started
half an hour.
The series with that?
No, that was in the middle of the, the middle of the series. So anyway... Here's what happened. So it's 1863. So far, the Robert E. Lee's like Northern Virginia has won everything. They have absolutely kicked the Union's ass so hard for two straight years, and the Union generals and the Union just has like totally no idea what's going on. They've moved generals and changed generals like all these times, and all the Union generals are like so overly cautious, and they like won't attack at what is, well, I mean, in hindsight, it's like, you should have fucking attacked there, you idiot. You let them get away. But anyway, and Robert E. Lee's like tactics, and especially with the cavalry with Stonewall Jackson and General Longstreet, was like really, really well done. And they just won like everything. So 1863, they decide to actually cross from the south to the north and attack in the north. And if they can deliver a very, decisive victory on northern soil, maybe they can get the Union, get Abraham Lincoln and the government in Washington to just like kind of give up and let the, and sue for peace. That's what they're hoping. And so at this point, the Southern Army, they're now like, they're like up in the north, so they're like away from their supplies, and they're like, and they clearly have a smaller army than the Union army, but they've still won everything up until this point. It's only a little bit smaller. So the Southern army is actually sort of in the northern position going into Gettysburg, because the Union army is actually trying to keep themselves between the Southern army and Washington D.C. So that's why they've actually been just cautiously going north while the Southern Army has been, and General Lee has been, pushing further afield. But in the way wars worked back then is that they needed the cavalry to actually scout around and find out where the other army was, because it was, like you said, it's so hard to figure out like where anybody was. However, Jeb Stuart, the Confederate like cavalry general, was just off doing his own thing, and did not find the Union army where they were, and did not supply any information to General Lee. And then when this spy comes in, it was like, hey, you should know where they are. Like, they kind of almost don't believe him. They're like, where's our fucking general? And Jeb Stuart had actually fucked up before that too, for some reason. I can't remember exactly why, but
he was out joyriding, they keep saying.
Yeah. So anyway, so the Southern Army is left a little bit in the dark, but they essentially get word that, you know, the Northern Army, they're just on the other side of this town called Gettysburg, and then like, well, okay, I guess we better attack them there because Robert E. Lee, he's trying to like win a decisive battle. So he's got to find them and attack them. So they go, and this battle ends up being 3 days long. The first day is there's like definitely some little battles here and there, but they weren't actually that big of a deal. It was really a more just all the other generals getting into position, all the other parts getting to position for like two pretty brutal days on day two and day three. So I don't really remember what happens on day one, but I do remember that I have a beer. Hold on. So wouldn't you say that a lot of people died and some people made some smart decisions. So could you call them savages and savants by equilibrium?
Apparently all the Southern generals are savants. They just know war and gentility. What was his name? Was it Chamberlain? Was he the smart guy?
Yep.
The professor?
He was a smart guy. Mm. Yep, this is nice. Very nice. Double IPA. Balanced by science.
Mm, that's the best kind.
It has like two Grim Reapers on the front. They're like holding beakers, though. That's the savant part. Anyway, yeah, it's nice. Mike, you were saying something?
The North Winds.
oh, yeah, right. So, Chamberlain. So, okay.
Oh, yeah. No, in the beginning, on day one, it's mostly like introducing us to the characters, because that's what is, you know, probably fascinating about the book to people, in that you get to know them. Like, Robert E. Lee is old and tired, and then who's the guy who has the dead kids? Longstreet, right? Mm-hmm. Who, his like all of his kids died of, you know, 1800s children diseases. And so he's just...
like the week before.
Yeah, he's a broken shell of a man, but he's like, I don't want to give up my slaves too, so let me keep fighting this war. And, you know, so you get all these... And then there's the Jeb Stuart guy who's joyriding, which, did you know anything about that guy? Like, he dressed up like a fucking... like Captain Hook, basically. Like, he wore a hat with an ostrich feather in it, and a cape when he rode his horse into battle. Like, he was a big, just showboater.
Well, like, so it's like, Pickett was dressed like fucking Liberace in the descriptions.
Well, I mean, apparently, you know, this was allowed back then that you could have several pieces of flair with your Confederate
your Applebee's uniform.
So they're like, what the fuck? Oh, guy's probably reading about himself in the papers again. Which is where they were getting military intel from. the other thing that I thought, I didn't know this about Gettysburg, is like it's like this nexus of a bunch of roads. So the whole first part of the book is just the slow lining up of all of the soldiers and people getting there. And it's like, ooh, will they get there? Do they know they should come here now? Kind of thing. That's really the big first part of the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, they spend the whole first chunk giving you maps like, this is where everybody was the first day at, you know, 9 a.m. And this is where the shooting happens at the next day at 12 p.m. and then 3 p.m. But you have to figure, like, something must have happened around, I don't know, like 10:50. This is 10:50 from Oscar Blues, and it's a 10.5% stout. Beer. And I've seen this in the store for months, and I thought, I could never use that. But here we are. 10:50.
We're not doing the novel, the biography of 50 Cent until next year.
Is it Loch Ness Monster? Tastes like a stout.
Ooh.
But it's in a little can.
It's a little can, so I'm not going to hurt myself too much because it's strong as fuck. It's got a hearty flavor. It's not one of those pastry stouts. It's more of a old-timey. Doesn't it is that, you know, that malt flavor and maybe a slight coffee effervescence, but it's good. And, you know, it's not giving me diabetes, so
strike.
I like it. I'm gonna drink the whole Nate, fucking thing.
Nate, you're gonna teach us more.
All right. So the book decides to focus on, even though it has a bazillion characters, which are all these generals, it really mainly focuses on...
mainly?
General Chamberlain. Yeah, mainly it focuses on General Chamberlain from Maine, who was a college professor who, according to this book, 20,000
women. Wrong Chamberlain, sorry.
According to this book, who always wanted to be a soldier, so I don't know why he didn't just go be a soldier before.
So he learned Hebrew and Latin.
Yeah, he spoke seven languages, like taught seven languages.
He taught at Bowdoin. And he ran the school my aunt worked at her whole life. Bowdoin.
Oh, yeah. Bowdoin?
Bowdoin, but they'd say it.
It looks Bowdoin. Like one of the dwarves from The Hobbit.
It is. It was named after one of them, but no one knows how to pronounce it.
Gloin and Bowdoin.
Bowdoin is the name of the dwarf strip club they go to.
They have an advanced pancake degree you can get there. Certificate in second breakfast.
But he was a pretty interesting guy, though you don't get any of that from the book. You get it from the about the characters after the war ended section at the end.
Oh, that part that's like the end of an 80s movie?
Yeah.
So, when you first meet him, he's like, I'm just taking command of the regiment, the 20th Maine. And the guy, messenger comes up to him and says, oh, we're giving you 120 soldiers, but you have to shoot them. And he's like, wait, what? They're from Maine? I have to shoot them? He's like, yeah, they're trying to,
They mutinied.
Mutiny, yeah. They're trying to mutiny. They thought they had signed two-year enlistments, but it was actually 3 years, so they can't leave. So clearly they just didn't read the terms and conditions. They just clicked through.
They just clicked agree. Like, let me watch the porn.
They just clicked through too fast. And so now they're pissed because they thought they were done, but they actually have another year. And they're like, man, we're tired. But Chamberlain, because he's a, nice guy, gives them a speech about the meaning of the Civil War and fighting for freedom. And then he says, listen, I've been told I should just shoot you if you don't get back in the army, but I'm not going to do that. However, we have to move out because we've just been told to take up a position on this little hill called, checks notes, Little Round Top. Yeah, okay. But however, I'm not going to shoot you, but you got to come with us.
From Temple of Doom, right? Little Round Top? Isn't that the little kid?
Short Round?
Yeah. Yes, that's what I'm going for.
Though I will say the ice cream place that my family goes to that was near my grandma's house in Maine is called Round Top.
Might be, yeah. So, I doubt it, but...
Who the fuck knows?
So, anyway, and they're like, but come with me anyway. You don't have to... I'm not going to shoot you. You don't have to, fight yet, but, I'll deal with you guys later. So, they go, they get into position, and then they are told...
He feeds them. He gives them food. He's like, wins them over.
Yeah, he's like, generally nice. He's like, listen, I'm not going to shoot you, but we're generally fighting for freedom.
Nice. I have one question. That you might know the answer better than me. Definitely, you'll know better than me. He's talking to the other guys and is like, this is a different kind of war. We've never done this before. We're doing this kind of war to set a man free, to set men free. Never done before. Like, the average northern soldier really feel that way?
I think by this point in the war, the rhetoric got to be more like that.
Mm. So, and actually, I want to say... In the beginning, because the army was an entire volunteer army,
except
up until 1860, the middle of 1863. So these all people who volunteered, and why would you go do that unless you believed in it? And so, very, very likely, plenty of people did. I mean, abolition was huge. People really believed in it. Sure, other people were just like, hey, this is the most exciting thing that'll ever happen in my life of just farming. So you know what? I'm just going to go do it because all my friends are and stuff like that. Or I have absolutely no job and this is a thing I can do.
Or I just got off a boat from Ireland and now I'm in the Civil War.
Yeah, that
this is
too.
My best chance to get a wooden leg.
this is my best chance to lose both my arms on the same day without anesthesia.
Who's got no thumbs and hates slavery? It's me. You just can't tell. But one of the questions of Lincoln biographers is always. What the fuck was Lincoln thinking? Because in the beginning of the war, he's like, I don't fucking care about slavery that strongly.
He was like, I don't like it, and I would kind of like to get them just all the fuck back to Africa if I had my own way, but we can't have them starting wars and shit, so we got to do something about this, I guess.
He has a quote, some, I forget what he said, but it's something like, if I can end the war by freeing all the slaves, I would. And if I could end the war by keeping all the slaves, I would. Right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Whatever ends yeah. the war.
He didn't run for president believing he wanted to break up the Union and start the Civil War. So, like, he wasn't, as a politician, going to free the slaves. Like, that wasn't, I mean, people in the South thought he was. That's why they started the Civil War. But he probably wouldn't do that now. But when the war is, like, we're a couple of years into the war and the South is still not giving up, is when Lincoln is like, you know what? Fuck it. take it away.
Taking our toys and going home.
Yeah. Well, first it was the Emancipation Proclamation, which didn't free all the slaves, only the slaves in the, like, recaptured territories. No, in the non-recaptured territories. No. Anyway, yeah, it wasn't until near the end of the war they got the 13th Amendment passed through Congress and ratified that officially freed all the slaves.
But what happened to the states that had slaves that did, like, I think Kentucky was a slave
Missouri.
State that didn't join? There were a few that they were like, "Now we'll stay. We're gonna let's see where this goes." And they
playing both sides.
Yeah, right? You never know.
Probably one of the reasons.
I'm like 3/5 on the side of Lincoln.
Probably one of the reasons why Lincoln didn't just free the slaves right at the beginning of the war, because there were slave states still in the Union.
So the battle's happening, and the first day generally kicks all sorts of ass. And everyone's like, chalk up another one for Robert E. Lee. But it's kind of like not the battle yet. It's just like a little small taster.
Well, it's like most of the Union guys hadn't even gotten there yet. And they're just like, we got one brigade holding off all of the Southern Army right now. And they did okay. But it was like, this is bad.
Hold on. What's the difference? There's like these terms. And I felt like I was supposed to know the difference between a brigade.
No, you only know that when you've owned three lawnmowers. And you keep upgrading. I think it's when you get your first riding mower. No, that's when you found out about Gettysburg existed. But when you get to three lawnmowers, you learn the sizes of Civil War army units.
Yeah, he's only a brevet general or whatever the fuck. But they keep throwing this terminology out there. It's like, it's only, give me two brigades and I'll take the hill.
A brigade, a division, and a corps. Sure. Yeah, I don't know the difference either. I'm sure it's just numbers. Okay. It's like a division. There are three brigades per division, and each brigade has four corps, something like that. I don't know. I'm sure those aren't the right numbers.
Is this fucking the money from Harry Potter?
It's like gallons and pints and quarts.
The only other thing I think that important on day one is that the Union guy that everyone liked, Reynolds, gets killed.
Immediately.
Is he like one of those guys that famously died like, they'll never hit us from this distance? Something like that?
I think he was just like, one of those guys who was like, we're going to get this shit done and let's go fight these Southerners, and just gets whacked on like minute two of day one. They're like, oh shit, that guy's gone. We got a real problem. Even the Southerners are like, did you hear they got Reynolds? It's like, oh shit, that guy? He was pretty cool for a fucking Yank.
Well, a lot of the generals knew each other
at
the
point.
Yeah, because
they had been in the Mexican War
College Point
15 years before that or whatever.
Oh, man, this is embarrassing. I don't know the answer to this. But isn't, like, the Mexican War a big reason for the Civil War?
In a way, yes. So the Mexican War happens in the middle of the
1840s. It was said to me once by someone's like, you can't possibly explain the Civil War without talking about the Mexican-American War.
Well, I mean,
I was like, yeah,
that's because
totally.
All events lead
I'm
to
another
events.
Beer. And then I left.
Well, yes. Okay, here's the reason. So in the Mexican War, the United States kicks Mexico's ass and takes a whole bunch of territory, which is all in the southern part of the country, which all the Southerners are like, yes, more slaves. And all, everyone in the north is like, oh, fuck, more slaves. And so that doesn't help tensions.
Well, because they had like the, my timeline of this period of history, I realize, I don't remember anything since junior year of high school.
Mexican-American War was like the late 40s.
Kansas-Nebraska Act or whatever, right? Yeah. They're like, you got to come in two by two, like the Noah's Ark.
That was later.
Mexican-American War was like 1846,
Mexican-American
right?
War was like, Texas is like, we want to be part of America. Fuck Mexico. But first, we're going to be independent for a week and tell everyone we're independent forever.
I think that's like, I think it's like 13 months. Yeah. So I think they have.
And they won't shut the fuck up about it.
Oh, no.
And then they elected.
Here's our flag at the same height.
And they elected, no shit, my ancestor, James K. Polk, who was like, if you elect me, I will start a war with Mexico and then I will leave.
That's literally what he did.
He did that. He's like, one other turn? Like,
explains
no,
why
I've done everything I ever wanted to do.
Nate, this would explain why Jimmy likes to go harass the men outside of the Home Depot.
Man, I went to Mexico City last year, and I went to the Mexican Independence Museum, and they had a whole section on the Mexican-American War and a big picture of him, and I was like, oh, man, I'm the bad guy here. It's like, this fucking dickhead gringo was just like, hey, guys, fuck you, and started a war with us. We didn't do fucking anything to this fucking cholo.
That's a true statement.
They really did nothing to him. He was just a dick. He's like, I'm just going to take this. This is ours now.
I mean, he campaigned on annexing Texas,
yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah. He was like, and he said, then, if like, you elect me, this is what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to peace out, having achieved all my... But honestly, most efficient president we ever had. Piece of shit, but it's like, hey, I got mine. I'm out. Thanks. Good luck, America.
To make an omelet.
You have to respect that, I guess.
Game respects game, okay. I believe, is the... Is this
yes, I think that's what his successor, Zachary Taylor, said. Game
Old
respects game,
feathers.
Good sir.
Yeah. So, all right. So, first day, I mean, a first day that the armies are only like discovering that each other are even there and are just like, oh shit, there's a southern army. There are soldiers over there.
There's 50,000 so guys over there.
Wasn't very organized.
They must have been able to smell these armies from.
They keep talking about how there's like fucking tens of thousands of dudes on each side. It's a massive amount of people.
Plus horses and it's hot as balls. There's guys dying. They're literally melting. There's guys who are dying in the sun because they're wearing like woolen uniforms.
Wool breathes.
They have
that's what they keep telling us. It's a wool suit. It breathes. Like, I'm dying. Fuck you.
They have not bathed. In their lifetimes, they must have reeked so fucking bad. Like, this was the first recorded case of chemical warfare. Like, the cloud of just, when the rebel yell, when they just, like, make turkey noises and run at each other. You know, like, the fearsome rebel yell of the South? Have you ever actually heard what it sounds like? it's pretty much that. You watch, like, Civil War reenactors, where you get... Old guys who, like, their middle name is Jefferson Davis. They can run at each other in a field. They're like, and they sound like a turkey being raped. And that was apparently the most fearsome sound.
Anyway, first day, doesn't really matter. Second day, there's a lot of fighting that happened, but the book focuses on Little Round Top. So, okay. We've got the situation by the second day where you've got two armies that are pretty much facing off over like a several mile front, but it's like in the shape of like a hook. It's in the shape of like a big curve. Now, also, in military strategy, or at least military strategy of this time, a lot of it boils down to just trying to get around the side and attack them from the side, also known as a flanking maneuver. So, the 20th Maine... And General Chamberlain, their job is to defend the end of the line. It was literally to defend the left flank. And on top of this small hill, there's like a bigger hill sort of in the middle, or not quite the middle, but like next to them. But there is a little hill next to it called Little Round Top. And they were told, defend this at all costs. To the last man, defend this. 10 minutes after they get there is when the Southern Army attacks. No, Rebel Army attacks with X wings. No, so they charge. So okay, they're on the top of a hill behind like a stone wall, and so the Rebel Army, they have to actually charge up a very rocky hill, which is like hard to do anyway, because you know have you ever tried walking up a flight of stairs? Like, it's hard work. And it's hot, and they're being shot at from guys behind cover. So this huge army is like, this huge number of guys are trying to take this hill, and the 20th Maine just keeps shooting them and like keeps pushing them back. They like try and charge, then they fall back, and they charge again, and then they fall back. It was like five times, eight times. I mean, it was a lot. And then the main regiment, the 20th Maine, they're running out of ammo, and there's like another charge. And so Chamberlain decides, because he like is a college professor and he's like read the textbooks on like military tactics, he spur of the moment, he's like, okay guys, we're gonna do this bayonet charge. So all of you guys over here on the left, we're going to like swing around with a bayonet charge and get in, like sort of like strike the rebels as they're coming up the hill, but from the side. In this little maneuver, I forget what it's called, is one of the most decisive moments of the war. Because after this, the rebels, the whatever regiment that was, they just stop. They're like, we can't do this. We have too many dead. We cannot take this hill. And so the Union, they hold the flank. They like hold their line. And so the General Lee doesn't have anybody try and attack them again. So they literally have the high ground. So eventually by the next day they get cannons up there and stuff, which is going to make it much easier. But this was one of the most decisive, like not only battles of the parts of the Battle of Gettysburg for sure, and one of the most decisive parts of the war, because they just couldn't take the flank, which meant now the Southern Army, they have just worse options. Like their options for winning are now much worse. And so on the third day is when General Lee is going to like make a really bad decision for Pickett's charge, but it was because they lost Little Round Top first.
So is the whole point in these days is the flank? If you attack, like you'll break their line. Is that
if
what
you
it
can
is?
Get behind kind of them, scatter? Their position.
It's sort of like
fucked.
If you can get to the side of them or behind them, you can if you can shoot all of them, but they can't shoot you back very well, so you can just like wipe them out. You can just wipe out the other army much easier.
But it still feels like it's, you know, that like old timey, we will take the field kind of battle, as opposed to we killed all those dudes kind of battle.
Well, Pickett's charge was more of a like, we're going to take that field kind of thing, but a lot of people died.
There's also a thing throughout the book of some of the older Confederates thinking it's kind of a pussy move to entrench and build little walls and shit like that. They keep calling, what's his name, the King of Spades, because he dug trenches.
Longstreet, yeah.
A lot of the Southern generals are all about, I don't know, showmanship's not the right word, but they're like, you know, the romantic glory of war, and they believed very much in their righteous cause, you know, states' rights, would, you know, ensure them victory because God was on their side. And it wasn't just like, this doesn't work logistically, dudes. It's just like, well, no, we are doing the right thing, so we will win. And everyone believes strong enough, therefore we will win. Meanwhile, Longstreet's like,
oh, yeah.
Guys, this is a really stupid fucking idea. Guys, no, don't do that.
Well, the character in the book, Jubal Early, he's the guy who created the Lost Cause myth. That was him after the war. It was like, no, it was an honorable thing to do. And then people, you know, that feels so much better than we were a racist. That feels nicer.
It was about states' rights. So the thing about Longstreet.
It wasn't about states' wrongs.
Thing about Longstreet and the King of Spades thing about gigging defensive fortifications is that the Civil War happened. It looked a lot more like Napoleonic Wars, but really the technology was getting a lot better. Like guns were getting, well, so they were using muskets or like rifles were just being invented. And that kind of tactics that Longstreet wanted to use, which is like you dig a trench, that's what they did in World War One. Like essentially he's predicting the kind of war that would actually happen in World War One, where rifles were guns, were now rifles, and were now much more accurate. And so you just had to hide in a trench. It was, and you make the enemy charge you in your defensive position, and then you just take them all out. They didn't have machine guns yet, though. So that would be the decisive change that would happen in World War One. That would make just defending behind your trench with a machine gun like way too strong. But he's predicting the way war would go in the next century.
Do we know if he actually, some of the, you know, I guess we could understand, like, if we knew how, like, Robert E. Lee felt about things, because he was, you know, well-known, researched, and all that shit, but, like, the rest of these guys, do we know that this is what the things in these books, the things they were saying, because I know this is a fictionalized account, and it's...
According to Wikipedia, what's his name? Michael Cera relied heavily on Longstreet's memoirs to write this.
So he wrote this stuff. Okay.
So he wrote about that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Who knows if he was lying?
Longstreet would survive the war and become, at one point, a U.S. Minister to the Ottoman Empire. That was his job.
Well, can't go anywhere but up from here.
Yeah, like Rutherford B. Hayes is like, let's let this guy be diplomat in the Ottoman Empire. He's like, we already lost the war. Why this indignity?
So, okay, day three, the third and most decisive day of the entire war. So you've got this whole Union line, and Lee is determined to attack them and destroy them, but doesn't have any really good options. So he decides on attacking the center of the line. Now
he'll never see it coming.
when I went to Gettysburg, I think I was 11 or something like that, and took the tour. And you of course walk you to the field where Pickett's charge happens. And here's what the tour guide said. The tour guide said that Napoleon used to do this all the time. That because all the generals knew that you have to reinforce your flanks, because that's where, everyone's trying to attack the flanks. You have to reinforce your flanks. But that means the center of your whole line is actually going to be quite a lot weaker. So what if you just attack right down the middle in a surprise attack, a surprise charge, and then there won't be enough guys to defend, and then you split the army, and then you can attack the two sides much more effectively? He said that that's what Napoleon used to do. And in this book actually mentioned, Napoleonic tactics. So it actually, this book also thought the same thing. Maybe he went on the same tour at Gettysburg. Might have been it. I don't know if that's true, because, I mean, I don't know a ton about Napoleon, but I don't know when he used that exactly. Anyway, but this is what Lee was trying to do. He was like, you know what? We're not going to take a little round top, and we're not going to be able to take the other side, but let's pull a Napoleon and just attack in the middle. Meanwhile, everyone else thought this was a terrible idea. Longstreet, everyone else was like, what? Like, there's no way. This is going to be a slaughter. This is going to be terrible. And General Lee's like, nope. Now, in the Southern Army, people really looked up to Robert E. Lee, because he fucking had won everything up to this point. So, he's like, the men are with me. They'll do whatever I tell them to. And he was right. This was not one of those times when they should have. Apparently, at least according to Ken Burns documentary, the Union general, Meade, he guessed correctly that Lee would try this. And it was the first time in the war that any Union general had actually correctly figured out what Lee was going to do and was able to counter it. So he guessed that Lee was going to attack right down the center in what would become Pickett's charge. And so we reinforced the center, although one of these regiments they send to defend the center was actually the 20th Maine. So Chamberlain and his division were also there at Pickett's charge. Anyway, so the book goes on and on about the planning for Pickett's charge and all this stuff. And they're like, oh, and the General Pickett, his division is fresh. These are all these fresh guys. They're not tired. They're not,
fresh people can't be hurt by bullets. They've got the energy.
They won't be too tired to do this. Or maybe what he actually meant is these are fresh 19-year-olds that have never actually been in a battle. So they're excited. They won't know that this is one of the dumbest things you could possibly do. And which is, when on D-Day, they didn't send in the veterans. They sent in the 19-year-olds. Because 19-year-olds would be like, well, this is what I have to do. I'm going to do it. And not the veterans would be like, no, that's craziness. I would never get off that boat onto that beach. Not that they wouldn't, but the veterans would know how incredibly dangerous, how incredibly just unlikely you are to live. Anyway, that's a different thing. So the book goes on and on about, General Longstreet is like, but sir, and all this stuff. And Pickett is like, okay, great. This is going to be my big moment of glory. Yay. I finally get to take part in a battle. And everyone was like, that is still so dumb. You're going to walk right down the middle where everybody's firing at you. The cannons are going to fire at you from every angle. all the way through, and there are still tons of guys right there. But it's like, nope, let's do it. And so they go, and, you know, General Pickett is like, charge, charge, and they just walk. They have to walk more than a mile across open fields with, like, cannons firing at them. This is, like, Pickett's, like, divisions. And more than half die. Like, and this all happened in, you know, a matter of minutes. Apparently, no one who made it to the Union line or who made it all the way to, like, the stone wall, which was right about where the Union line was, no one who made it to the stone wall came back. They all either died or they all either died or were captured. And this is where those two, like, best friends, two guys who are now generals, who were best friends before the war, where they both died. Was it Hancock and Armistead, something like that?
Oh, they had that one chapter from Armistead.
Yeah, so that's why. Now, as far as the book goes, if you already knew this story, this would be a better part of the book. But, like, these are two brand new characters you didn't know anything about. So it's like, oh, and Wiz Hancock... Tell Hancock I'm sorry. And it's like, well, okay, great.
Tell him he doesn't have to give me back that $5.
And then this is pretty much almost the last scene of the book, because, like, after the, after most of Pickett's divisions get divisions, brigades, corps, whatever the fuck it's called, after a whole lot of them die, and some in the Confederate soldiers, they actually just turn around and go back. And General Lee, apparently in real life, it did, like in the book, and also in real life, said, it's all my fault. I made a mistake. This is all my fault. And then from that point on, the Confederate Army, they can't sustain losses this big. I mean, not only for out, like, the whole 3 days of Gettysburg, but also because they're running out of ammunition and, like, so many people were dead. Like 50,000 dead and wounded or something like that out of 150,000. Maybe it wasn't 50, but it was a lot. And, like, this Confederate Army, they don't have nearly as many people, nearly as many supplies. So they now have to turn around. They actually basically turn around and go back to Virginia. And they're on the defense for the rest of the war. Like, they never really have to any type of, they never really attack again.
Which is what, like, Longstreet, who maybe is the voice of everyone telling General Lee in this book, is saying, like, we shouldn't be up here in the first place. Like, we're seceding. All we have to do is sit in the South and fight a defensive war, make them come to us, and just not want to keep coming for us. There's no reason for us to be here. Just got to wait it out. Eventually, we'll win. And Lee is like, no, we've got to just strike a blow now. And then they'll give up. It's like, this is a bad idea. It's going to take a little while, but we can do it if we just sit it out. Just sit there and wait. It's like, no, got to do it for the South. And
Longstreet might have been right, but he also might not have. Because
this one certainly didn't just work either way.
That wasn't Gettysburg wasn't the only bad thing to happen to the South.
No.
There was a total naval blockade, so they couldn't get any sort of supplies or help Grant took back Tennessee, was winning a whole bunch of battles. And in fact, Meade is pretty much the only Union general to win anything besides Grant.
Didn't Sherman burn down all of Georgia?
Oh yeah, that too. but that's after Lincoln promoted Grant over everybody's head to be, like, the supreme commander of all the Union Army. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So, and so they just wouldn't... Now, they could hold on, but the North had so many more soldiers, so many more, like, factories to produce the guns, the ammunition, the boots, the uniforms, and these supplies, all the stuff. So the Union had a lot more. So the South would not have done well.
There's a conversation, because there's, like, a weird posse of international soldiers who are following around.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the random English guy. Real. And the Prussian guy who's mad no one speaks German. And they're debating, they're having their stupid conversations, and they play, like, gin rummy or something. And the Southern generals all agree, No, you shouldn't keep the ammunition factories open on Sundays. It's not that bad. And, you know, to do so would be an affront to the way the things Lord. Are supposed to be. Because they're, you know, they're so fixated on, like, decorum of war and whatever. So they're foolish. Like, the South, you know, they're outnumbered and outgunned. And they're like, but let's not run those bullet factories on Sundays because, you know, baby Jesus or something.
There was a thing in the war, like, because, like, the British were there. They weren't taking sides until, you know, they were saying, like, maybe later on. And one of the generals in the book was like, they'll take sides once it's, like, a sure thing that one side's going to win because they're, you know, shit. But, like, at the beginning of the war, they didn't want to take sides because they relied a lot on cotton that the South produced, and they didn't want to fuck up their
business.
Well, that's
why they would take sides. Yeah, so the North, so the Britain's, like, massive textile factories relied on cotton grown in the South. They, like, absolutely relied on it. And so one of the things that Lincoln did was he immediately, like, ordered a naval blockade of the South so they couldn't sell any of it. Like, that would economically starve the South. And in really the only important foreign policy that Lincoln ever had to do was kept Great Britain neutral, made sure that they didn't subjoin the South's side in the war. That was also very important.
And one of the only times embargoes actually worked.
Didn't it cause like hyperinflation in the Confederacy? They had like 1,000% inflation.
They had their own fucking money that they made up, so whatever.
Yeah, they just printed their money.
But they had, even with that silly money, they had ridiculous, towards the end of the war, rampant hyperinflation.
That's because it wasn't backed by gold. It was fiat currency. I don't know. Fuck, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Where would they get gold? They couldn't buy gold anywhere.
Fort Knox is in Tennessee. I don't know. I have no idea.
Wasn't it in Kentucky?
I don't know.
Kentucky was in the Union.
God damn it.
It probably wasn't even a
stymied
thing.
Stymied at every turn.
I just know it from Die Hard 3.
Yeah, so the book ends, and it's just kind of like, yeah, we're all sad now.
Well, we're not.
And then there's a where are they now section, which I did not read.
It was, you know, a few of them went on to die the next week at another fight. Some others went on to do other things. And then Chamberlain had this long, illustrious career and died. It said he died of his... He got into another fight later on, another battle, not a fight. He was in the war. Didn't get, like, punched at a bar. He had some crazy wounds and some next battle. And then he said he died of his wounds after having a decades-long career afterwards. Like, he,
yeah, like 20 years it took him to die.
Yeah,
that
like he got shot like through the hips or some shit like that, which would, you know, you'd bleed out instantly normally, but he lived forever and just was sick the rest of his life and died of his bullet wounds decades later. It's like, does that count at that point? I don't know, man.
It's definitely the kind of wound where he could feel when it was going to rain or something, you know, like in his hip.
It's raining blood all the time.
Oh, yeah. He was a Slayer fan, yeah.
Yeah.
But it would, you know, raining that was the G, kind, that's the kind of wound where, you know, you get weird humidity psychic powers. But he died like in like the 1890s or something.
Yeah, he was like he went back to teach and became president of the college and was just like an all-around awesome dude.
Did he become governor of Maine as well?
He was governor of Maine and then went back to being president of the school. That dude, he sounds like a pretty interesting guy. I think he was more interesting than
Chamberlain,
this book.
Right? Well, it's crazy. He died in 1896, which seems so much later than the war, but he was 55.
he was 55 in 1896?
Yeah. He was 22 at the Battle of Gettysburg.
He seemed like a wizened old man. In this book.
Well, he had already buried 9 children.
Yeah. What the fuck? Okay. I didn't look at his birthday, so I figured, like, yeah, he made it to, like, you know, 70 maybe.
So General George Armstrong Custer was also at this battle and in a wild cavalry charge. But I remember, just because this is in the Ken Burns thing, and it said, and 26-year-old General Custer led this charge. Like, he was 26 and he's a general?
Battlefield promotions were a hell of a thing. Yeah,
I think you
got several in this book.
If you came out of West Point, you started pretty high up
because they needed anyone with any training and experience. They needed just anyone. You always think of generals as being like old, but nope, 26. I mean, Napoleon wasn't old. He was like in his 20s. Well, when he first became general.
You just need a couple of battles with panache and you can get promoted.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's really about panache.
So what did you guys think of the book?
Mostly, it wasn't the worst thing we've read. It was mostly just boring.
Yeah. It was, you know, the thing that struck me the most about it was they kept mentioning there's tens of thousands of people on both sides, and it never felt in the book like it was happening between more than like 20 dudes. You got no sense of the scale of it other than, by the way, there's 80 other thousand people here. Like, if you say so, man.
And maybe that's Michael Shara falling a little into the great man of history mode.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to write a first person account from, you know, three or four persons perspectives on the battle, but it was hard to get a sense of the scale. And as someone who doesn't really know anything about the logistics of the Battle of Gettysburg, I didn't feel like I actually, other than the fucking pictures, really got a sense of it through the writing. It was kind of like the same five guys doing everything.
Yeah, and especially since I don't know what a fucking brigade or a division means. You know, how many men that are talking about as they describe them, like, you know, pawns.
I mean, you know, it's even if you know, it's like it's got to be like there's a few hundred guys here, but it still never felt more than like three. It was like General Chamberlain, his wisecracking brother, and his Irish servant.
Oh yeah, the one who has to in front of people. He's like, don't. Let's. If you have to pretend we're serious, you know, yeah. Like I'm like, guys, not maintaining, you know,
you can't use my first name out here.
No eye contact. Yeah, I'm sure that Shara didn't. I mean, he doesn't care. It's not about the regular soldier, right? It's about the great men behind the battle, the forces of it.
And I mean, no doubt that they were definitely important. That's how these things happen. It's like that guy says do this thing, and everyone had to do it. It was very hyper focused. Not that this needed to be a great historical thing. It's fucking dad pop historical fiction. It's not a Ken Burns documentary. So that's not what it is. So, you know, I'm not going to fault him for that. But I don't know. I also don't give a fuck about Civil War specifics like enough. So this is not really. It's not my scene. Also not his fault. You know, amateur dad fiction, gotta say, probably one of the top ones.
Between this and having read now one Tom Clancy book, I just don't know if anyone will step foot on my grass again. I will just be on that porch yelling.
I mean, Watership Down, I think, was better than this, but other amateur dad fiction, also about war.
With the General Robert Bun E.
I just listened to a podcast series about Robert E. Lee and why he was a piece of shit. They seized his house in Arlington because he was, quote unquote, not paying his taxes because they had seceded. So they took back the territory and seized his property, and they started burying Union soldiers there. And that's how we got Arlington National Cemetery. They said, by the way, we started a cemetery on your land. Fuck you.
Yeah, it's Robert E. Lee's house.
That's awesome.
I love that. What a dick.
Well, from that story alone, I don't get the sense that he's a dick so much as the United States of America.
I mean,
was
this book also does lean heavily into Robert E. Lee was this great man who just, you know, loved the South so much that he had to do the right thing by
Virginia.
Yeah, he just loved it. But, like, you know,
yeah, he didn't. So in the beginning, it said, like, you know, he didn't love slavery, but he just loved Virginia. So he had to do that. I mean, Grant really, I mean, Lincoln, at the very beginning of the war, Lincoln offered command of the whole Union Army to Robert E. Lee. But instead of taking it, he resigned and joined the Confederate Army instead. Another interesting fact. Yeah, no, it's just the book was just kind of long and boring. Wasn't bad. It was just like,
it's just like, why does this exist? It's like, if you don't like, I want to read the history of Gettysburg, but I don't want to read 500 dense pages. I'll read this instead and get a good enough idea about it. This is the tour. This is the novelization of the tour of Gettysburg.
Kind of, yeah. That's a good way to say it.
That's why the last chapter about the gift shop was so odd. You have to read the gift shop chapter to close the book.
You must exit through the gift shop.
I think it was fine. There are parts of it I really enjoyed, and a lot of like I liked the humanizing parts. Like, this guy's dealing with the horrible loss of his children, and he's just like, I need anything to distract me. I forget, there's one chapter where...
I know, Pickett's charge.
Right, but he's just like... He's like, then finally all the other soldiers left, and he had no choice but to see the dead faces of his children again. Like, to show, like, that these were people, because it's very easy to forget that when there's just like a history lesson. I liked that part of the book.
I thought some of the characters were definitely interesting, but once again, I don't know how accurate they are. Like, I'm sure some of them were accurate. I'm sure some of them were not.
Of course, yeah, I don't know how accurate any of that is. I just liked that. That was more fun to me than reading another history book where they're like, and then a force of 41,000 soldiers marched northwesternly through this. I don't like that at all.
It's definitely less dry than history.
I don't know. So I read a nonfiction book, an actual historical history book about the Civil War, and I thought it was quite interesting. It was long. Definitely was a fucking super long book, but I found it actually pretty interesting.
It all depends on what you're into. There's an entire genre of military history books that exist because Dad saw one at Sears, and he was like, I'm going to get this along with my new microwave. these books are very, very, very popular for a reason, but it's never been like a genre that I was like the infinitesimal details of day to day happenings of war. I get kind of tired, and that's not to say that it's bad. It's just that it's not for me, and so this is probably the most I ever would learn about Gettysburg. So yeah, I guess I'm thankful that I know this much. It's better than nothing. It objectively is better to know this diluted, you know, coloring book version of it than nothing.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with reading it. It's certainly not for everybody. Wouldn't be a friend of mine who's older, even older than Nate,
Methuselah,
was reading this. The Tao. It's just the internal being.
Wowzoo.
But he was like, oh, you're reading Killer Angels. Like, oh, I'm so jealous. I remember the first time I read that. And then this is a guy who's read like three different biographies of Custer. Like he's like deep into the dad Civil
three
War
biographies
thing.
Of Custer. He just lost. That's what everyone knows him for.
But he's an interesting character.
Yeah. Oh, he's a crazy guy. Totally
real
crazy
shit bag.
Guy.
Oh, total asshole. But
apparently, in one battle, he shot his own horse. Three times or something like that.
That's saying something when you have to like get a new gun to shoot.
He had to, he had to tell that horse three times where to go. What do you tell a horse you shot three times? Nothing. You told it thrice. Yeah. He's like, Liz, that was like a gateway for me. I have not walked through that gateway yet. And I realize I'm the only one here who is a dad. And I'm good.
You're the closest to the gateway of us.
I'm staring into the abyss.
The day you start suggesting like the workings of the USS Alaska is the day I quit.
Hey, guys, let's just see if Jeff Shara had more to add. But I think it's fine. Should it have won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction? I don't know. I don't know what it was up against.
It's not even really... I mean, is this fiction? It's like...
Yeah.
It's in the middle fiction. Of it. But I don't know.
No, he made up all the words. I'll give him that.
He made up all the words.
But I think it's just kind of, it's not for everybody. But it wasn't the worst thing we've read in a while.
No, it was easy and relatively quick.
Like the Battle of Gettysburg.
Mm, yeah, that's what they say. Before we forget, the most important thing about the Civil War is that there were serious rumors that Robert E. Lee fucked his horse, Traveler. He wrote so many letters about how hot and awesome his horse was and how he used the word dilate, and it might have meant something different back then, but he talked about this horse's willingness to dilate when you needed it to. There are flags people make nowadays of Robert E. Lee fucking his horse over the Stars and Bars. And they are beautiful. And I'd like to believe it's true.
His horse is buried at Washington and Lee University. There's a tombstone for his horse.
Well, yeah, that horse had been through a lot.
It fought its own battle of man asses.
I think the horse was a receiver.
But if you go to the Wikipedia page on Robert E. Lee, it's incredible to see the pictures of him because he's a very photographed man for the time. There are multiple pictures of him. Some of these other guys have, if you look up George Meade's face, it looks like he has bags under his eyes that look like they're made out of scrotums. And he was 49 or something in this picture.
49 back then. It was a hard 49.
Very hard. It's like 49, but you're born on leap day, so you're actually 200. But if you scroll down, you see these pictures of a young Robert E. Lee. It's like a painted portrait from the 1830s.
There was a lot of stuff about him as a kid. Like he was a handsome person for the time.
Oh, yeah. Which maybe
by now is not great. But like back then, it was like he's a handsome guy. But also, everyone thought he was really fucking weird and kind of like who was like way too obsessed with like
fucking his horse
manners and being a fucking mama's boy. Also, his dad was a full blown like grifter and he never lived it down. And so when Robert E. Lee married his wife, his father-in-law hated Robert E. Lee's father so much that he wasn't okay with him getting married at all. And then when he died, instead of giving Robert E. Lee like passing on the house to them, he said, "This goes to my daughter and my grandchildren and not Robert E. Lee. Fuck that guy." And he said, "You can also all my slaves are freed within this amount of time." And Robert E. Lee was like, "I got to find a way to make money off these slaves." So he started sending them out to people to make as much money off as could of them in the limited time before he had to, quote unquote, free them. Because he was, just about states' rights.
States' rights to profit, Jimmy. But if you look at the picture of him next to the Mexican-American War section of his Wikipedia page, I really love his porn mustache he had in the 1850s.
Mm.
It is a look. Because you're used to seeing him, like the Civil War pictures of him. He's got like, a gray beard. But here he is looking like Roberto E. Lee. That is quite the mustache. I can't imagine.
That is, yeah. That's an interesting look.
Right. Magnum P.I. of the South. But he looks like a...
Well, he couldn't put the whole beard on because otherwise it would get horse on it from when he was rim-jobbing his horse.
Well, then look at the picture from up where he looks like Lewis Carroll, the daguerreotype from like 1845. He has like these mutton chops. He's like, this is a man. Don't let your kid buy this man.
He's doing that I'm feeling my nipple under my jacket pose that everybody did in the 1800s for some reason.
Wasn't it because they all had scabies? Isn't that the story that Napoleon posed like that so he could scratch his fucking lice? This guy has full blown horse lice all over him.
Well, that's what you get from fisting.
And you can't tell actually in that picture if his son has human legs or if he's a centaur. So
that's just the front look half at the of picture.
You can't tell. That could be a centaur boy. Yeah.
I could see the horse extending from that child. Am I your son? Nay.
Oh my God. All right. This is my son. He's so big. He's almost 10 hands. All right. Do we need to say anything else about Robert E. Lee?
Tell us what you thought. Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Follow us on X at drunkguysbc.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram X at drunkguysbookclub.
And leave us a review. Make it to 5 stars for every 5 stars a general has or some bullshit. I would know better if I was a better dad.
And check us out on Patreon at Drunk Guys Book Club and give us your money. We don't take Confederate money anymore. It's now a hate crime. Sorry, Dad. And find us on Goodreads.
And check out the Hopped Up Network, a network of independent beer podcasters. And thanks for listening.